Good morning, everyone. Here's your early morning news from Europe, as reported by NBC staff members and capitals abroad. For the report from Germany, we take you now to Berlin.
Directing effective attacks against Soviet railway lines, troop concentrations, marching columns, and shipping. In the area around Bryansk, Chernikov, approximately 200 kilometers southwest of the Red Capital, German reports state the Luftwaffe's bombers systematically and effectively attacked railway lines. In resulting air battles around this area, reports state that 45 Red planes were shot down. The Luftwaffe is also credited with successful attacks against Saroposhche and Pavlograd on the Dnieper Bend, where 5 Soviet trains are reported to have been heavily damaged. The report states that the railway station at Pavlograd was set afire. Further reports state that east of Dnipropetrovsk, German bombers machine-gunned and bombed marching Soviet columns, inflicting bloody Soviet losses. In the Black Sea area south of Ochotkov, German Stukas are reported to have scored hits on 2 Soviet auxiliary warships, causing the vessels to list heavily. The official German news agency, DNB, states that in the Gulf of Finland, German bombers damaged a 3,000-ton merchantman and adds that an additional 3,000-ton merchantman was also damaged south of Raval. While British planes were raiding southwestern Germany last night, the Luftwaffe was busy bombing airfields in Britain, according to reports available here this morning. The reports declare that the British planes dropped bombs at several points without, however, causing significant damage. The report states that German anti-aircraft fire shot down one of the raiders. In North Africa, German Messerschmitts are credited with shooting down 2 British Curtiss planes over Sidi Barrani. German military quarters state that a total of 109 Soviet planes were shot down or destroyed on the ground yesterday. According to the same quarters, a total of 14 British planes were sent crashing to the ground yesterday by German fighter planes and anti-aircraft. No German losses are reported. Foreign correspondents last night attended the usual preview in the German propaganda ministry of the latest German newsreel dealing with the war in the East. Correspondents were informed that 50 newsreel cameramen took over 40,000 meters of film, whereof but 800 meters will meet the eyes of the public. The camera graphically pictures the bombing of the Arctic port of Murmansk, as well as bomb attacks on the Stalin Canal, which connects the Baltic Sea with the Arctic Ocean. Further shots show German and Romanian troops entering the town of Nikolaev, with devastation apparent everywhere. Additional pictures show German infantry forcing the crossing of the River Bug. Swinging to the broad central front, the advance of a German cavalry unit into Gomel is pictured with dense smoke and fires visible in a large part of the town. There are the usual shots of endless streams of prisoners being brought to makeshift prison camps. The infantry and tank advances into Narva and Novgorod offer an excellent insight into the German method of attack. The infantry and tank units cooperate and function with the precision of a well-drilled football team. The newsreel ends with Stukas raining bombs down on the important Leningrad-Moscow railway line, the bomb hits scoring huge mushroom-like craters. The commercial attaché at the American Embassy, while driving along Berlin's east-west axis recently, managed to have a few words with the efficient Berlin traffic cops. The attaché, it seems, was driving along at a good 55-mile-an-hour clip, which is 10 miles beyond the speed limit. In his rear vision glass, he had recognized the nemesis of all fast drivers, but nevertheless maintained his pace until overtaken and ordered to the curb. 2 big, strapping policemen strode over to his car and asked if he did not know that the law had set the speed limit at 45 and not 55. The attaché, with a very serious expression, answered, "I was just keeping up with that army truck in front of me, as I was sure the army wouldn't break the law." The attaché did not get a ticket. German quarters briefly commented on the condition of Pierre Laval today. He stated, while the wounds inflicted are serious, his condition is not satisfactory. The German press and radio have carried but the bare report of the attempted assassination. This is Alex Dreyer in Berlin, now returning you to NBC in New York.
Now to Europe again, this time to Vichy, unoccupied France.
Hello, NBC. This is Paul Archinard in Vichy. Events have begun to hum in France. There are obviously many harassing moments in store for this country. But yesterday's attack on former Premier Vice Premier Pierre Laval and Marcel Déat, chief propagandist for collaboration, has staggered opinion here. Not that some sort of an attack was unexpected on two of the most unpopular men in France. Laval and Déat were forewarned that something might happen to them, but it was an irony of fate that they should have been shot by a member of the organization which they, more than anyone else, had been instrumental in creating. The Volunteer Legion for Fighting the Soviets was founded on the personal initiative of Marcel Déat. For the past weeks, recruiting centers have been functioning throughout the occupied zone to organize fighting units against the Bolshevists. The first contingent of these volunteers was assembled yesterday afternoon for the first time in Versailles. At the last moment, Laval and Déat decided to attend the ceremonies there, which centered around this anti-Bolshevist crusade. It seems that they might have felt insecurity amidst their followers, but at least one of these followers had enlisted only to get someone. This 20-year-old man from Normandy did not have long to wait. A few minutes after the flag dedication of the anti-Soviet Legion, when for the first time since the armistice the Marseillaise was sung in public in occupied France, volunteer Colette shot Laval and Déat as they were leaving the barracks after inspection. It is said that the weapon used was a modern 9-shot automatic pistol. If this is exact, the assassin's shooting was terribly effective, since he hit Laval and Déat twice and wounded an officer and another volunteer. Laval staggered to a waiting car unaided and was driven away by Ambassador de Brino, who had come out of the shooting unscathed. Déat's wounds were at first reported superficial, but although latest news this morning leads us to believe that Pierre Laval may pull through, Marcel Déat's condition is reported very serious. One of the bullets plowed through his intestines and necessitated a laparotomy operation. The man who, of all political writers, had most bitterly attacked the government in Vichy may not live through the week. And this all happens while workmen in Vichy are decorating the city with tricolor bunting for the gathering next Saturday of the French Legion of War Veterans. And now anti-communist measures are bound to become extremely drastic. In fact, the shooting in Versailles is held up as a justification for these measures, although there is still no certainty as to whether the shooter was a communist. The special court went into session in Paris yesterday to try communists arrested for sabotage or agitation. The session was held in camera, with only a half a dozen policemen present. Three men were sentenced to death, six others to sentences ranging from life imprisonment to 2 years in prison and 100 francs fine, the minimum. It is reported this morning that the three condemned to death were guillotined at dawn today in Paris, while the preventive arrest was started on a large scale. This is Paul Archinard in Vichy, returning you to NBC in New York.
Next, the news in Great Britain. Go ahead, London.
This is John McBain, London. British bombers last night attacked Mannheim and other targets in western Germany. The Channel ports and other objectives in France are reported to have been bombed. German air activity over Britain was slight. Military quarters in London today confirmed that the Iranians have ordered general mobilization. An Indian frontier expert, Lieutenant General Quinnan, is in command of the British troops in Iran. Army headquarters in India have stated that the Anglo-Russian advance is continuing with speed and determination. The advance seems to be making good progress, and British river gunboats have moved up the river from Bandar Shapur. The only regret discernible in London at the shooting of Pierre Laval is that the wound wasn't immediately fatal. The British press today is in full agreement in interpreting the shooting of the French quislings is a sign that France is awakening. French quarters in London declare that the policy of Pétain d'Arlon is responsible for the shooting. By their avowed collaboration with Germany, the Vichy leaders have taken away any hope of independence from the French people and driven them to solve their problems by drastic methods. Pétain's harsh attempts to force the French to accept his policy have made them desperate, it's said. The fact that German-controlled censorship at Vichy has for the past few days allowed the reporting of sabotage attempts probably means the Germans and the Vichy authorities are planning some new move against the French people. The reports may have been allowed to justify either some new German military action or wholesale executions to terrorize the French into obedience. Vichy's action in depriving General Vagon and General Nogues of any active control of the French African colonies is regarded in the best informed French and British circles here as opening the way for the Germans to take over French North Africa if they want to. There are strong indications here that this may come in the very near future. There's no information at French headquarters in London on General de Gaulle's offer of the French equatorial ports to America's naval bases. But it's long been known by those in touch with the Free French that if America wanted to use the bases, she could do so. In the opinion of observers who have followed the Free French movement closely, the United States, if it chose to accept the offer, could nullify a possible German move into Dakar, and so forestall a German attempt to control the South Atlantic. Those who keep in touch with the feeling in France say recognition by the United States of the Free French movement would have a tremendous effect on the French people. Yesterday's Vichy changes in the control of North Africa tied Dagon's hands, so that even if he wanted to, he could do nothing to oppose the Germans. If America were to withdraw recognition from Vichy, she would be openly admitting what most French people feel, that Vichy is German-controlled and that only the Free France represents the French people. French circles here say the present sabotage attempts are not part of an organized campaign, but merely the work of individuals who can't govern their bitter resentment at the Germans and Vichy's policy. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
And that's the latest news of the war. Now for the news at home, reported by Earl Godwin, speaking from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. I know this is not Washington news, but it will have a tremendous effect on some of our policies when we learn from the dispatch which has just this second been laid down in front of me, London, a report that the new Iranian cabinet has decided to cease resistance against British and Russian forces was circulated by Reuters agency today. And at the State Department, there is a tremendous lot of suppressed interest in exactly the situation in Iran, because there is the well-defined understanding that Iran may be the back door to Russia for American goods. And this town seems to be in an uproar today over a variety of major and minor matters. First in the public eye is the inquiry into the gasoline curfew. Senator Maloney of Connecticut heads the Senate's committee making this investigation. Ralph Davies, a California oil executive who is acting as oil conservator in Secretary Icke's absence, will probably be the first witness. Meantime, a list of straight gas prices at the pump is put out by Leon Henderson, the price controller. It is a suggested list only, no compulsion, and the prices range from 16.5 cents a gallon in this city to 20 1/10 cents a gallon in Manchester, New Hampshire. There's an interested group of senators who want to know whether the Association of American Railways can make good its claim that there are 17,000 or more oil tank cars that could be used in more efficient manner to reduce the eastern gas shortage. And the whole subject of oil pipelines versus other modes of transportation for oil may be discussed at these hearings, which start this morning. And incidentally, Washington just learns today that Philadelphia gas dealers largely have protested against the price set for gas in the city of brotherly love and want a half a cent a gallon more. A cabinet officer said to me last night, I'll quote him, "I think we are not so close to trouble in the European war as we were, but the Japanese trouble is real trouble, brittle and dangerous." That in answer to a question for me as to how real is this Japanese menace or trouble. At any rate, Washington observers feel that the steady pressure on Japan by this government is a part of the general agreement, possibly a part of the High Seas Conference. Nobody can be firmer or exert more real pressure than Cordell Hull, Secretary of State. No invective, no name-calling, very soft-spoken, but he has the Japanese government in a dither and a straitjacket, so we're informed. You know, they don't like the idea of American goods shipped across the Pacific to Russia. Mr. Hull points to the freedom of the seas. The Japanese know we have fought a couple of wars for that freedom. Ambassador Nomura, who is personally genuinely interested in bettering relations between this country and his, has done a lot of extra work on the subject and is expected to return to the State Department today, we think, on instructions from his government. Mr. Hull informs the Japanese over and over again that American favor toward Japan depends on Japan's behavior, and that's all from Washington at this time.
For latest news, keep tuned to this station. This is the National Broadcasting Company.